Okay, this is Gary Parrish from CBSSports.com. Again, it's now Friday, February 13th. Oh, my God, it's Friday the 13th. Are you guys okay? Did you get bothered by Friday the 13th? I really just realized this.
I'm not bothered by it. I'm not superstitious in that way, but it is actually kind of creepy that you mentioned that, and it's essentially been a week of death.
Some of which you predicted, let's be honest.
Oh my gosh. To the podcast listeners, I didn't mean to creep you out like that. I am not sentient to that degree, but I got to tell you, I probably had 40 at mentions at me, basically, calling me some sort of grim reaper, begging me not to kill their coach next. So there will be no death pool predictions on this podcast.
Thank God. Just for folks who might not have caught it, we did the Monday podcast, and we were reflecting on Dean Smith, the life of Dean Smith, the death of Dean Smith. And one of the points Norlander made, by the way, it's Matt Norlander and Sam Bassini here with me. One of the points Norlander made is that, we're fortunate enough to still have a lot of the giants of college basketball still living, whether it's Coach K or Larry Brown, Jim Boeheim, Rick Pitino, Lute Olson. And Norlander actually said, the next one to go will be Tarkanian. But then after that, and so we sort of joked about it. And then literally the next day, or maybe that same day, Tark was admitted to the hospital. And of course, Jerry Tarkanian died earlier this week. So it's certainly not a funny moment, but just sort of a weird moment. And we were giving it to Norlander a little bit about predicting deaths on Monday. So no, listen, whatever you do, please don't predict any doom for any basketball or any coach or any person, really. Just stay away from death if you can.
Yeah, no, let's not go into a dark place here. But that was, and actually the timing on Tarkanian's death, I think it happened as you were recording with Doster on Wednesday, so I don't even know if you addressed that. But, we don't have to get too deep.
No, you're right. I noticed that. I recorded with Rob Doster from NBC Sports Wednesday. I was in New York, and I think you're exactly right. I think Tark he certainly passed between the time that we recorded and the time the podcast got posted. Yeah. He certainly died, or at least it was announced at some point in between there, perhaps literally while I was recording. And so it is worth taking a few moments just to sort of reflect on Tark. I will tell you, I didn't know him well because he was retired by the time I got this job, and but I was around him some, at Final Fours, and I remember being in a hotel lobby once and sitting at a table having a drink with Tark and some other folks. And a few years ago, and this was probably the last long conversation I had with him, I was doing a Q&A actually for Athlon magazine, and they wanted something with Tark. This was late 2011, maybe. And so I remember talking to him on a Sunday afternoon. And it was one of those things where okay, you call on Sunday afternoon and we'll catch up then. So I call on a Sunday afternoon. I had family stuff to do. And I can remember even telling my wife, all right, listen, I got to go make a phone call. And then as soon as I'll knock this out, and then we'll go to dinner. And I don't mean this the wrong way. I'm just telling a story. I couldn't get him off the phone. He would not stop talking. And he was so bitter about the NCAA. We were talking a lot about the NCAA and how they treated him. And he just wouldn't. And I'm not saying wouldn't. I loved it. It was awesome. I had Jerry Tarkanian just going. And if you've read anything over the past 48 hours about Tark, he's a great storyteller. First off, he's got amazing stories, and then he's great at telling them. Some people have amazing stories, but they can't tell them. Some people can really tell stories, but they don't have any good ones. This guy had amazing stories, and he could really tell them. And so I had him on a roll, or he just had himself on a roll. And he was so, but I sort of hung up the phone feeling a little sad. Because here was a man whose health was clearly failing him, or at least heading in that direction. He had been sick for a while. And had so much resentment built up. Clearly, I'm not a psychologist, but there was a lot of stuff going on there, is what I remember from the conversation. And so I talked to Dave Rice, who of course played for Tark at UNLV, now is the head coach at UNLV, on Wednesday night, so a few hours after Tark died. And one of the things I asked him was, with the Hall of Fame induction that came in 2013 and the statue at UNLV, I was curious if Tark had found any sort of peace with all of that stuff, because, you know, when I talked to him at the age of, say, 81 or 82 at length on that Sunday afternoon, this was a man who had accomplished so much, like was one of the iconic figures of college basketball, but had never really been properly recognized that way. He was a guy who was still like the outlaw and all that, but, right. but there was no Hall of Fame, there was no statue, and yet, thank God, he got all that stuff late in life. Stuff that, let's be clear, he absolutely deserved, given his impact on the sport, regardless of what you thought of him. And Dave actually said he thought Tark found a lot of peace late in life because he did feel like, though it took too long, he was finally properly recognized by the establishments at both, you know, in basketball and specifically at UNLV. And, you know, I thought that was a neat thing. And it's really been a fun week. Let me explain.
I know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. We've got to sort of relive a lot of stories about Dean Smith and Jerry Tarkanian that I don't think people either A, knew or B, remembered. And it's never fun when an iconic figure or, you know, or someone like somebody's dad dies. But the idea that we've spent some time this week talking about two giants of the sport and being able to, at least from my position, learn more about them, but then tell stories about them that maybe other people didn't know. That's been a neat thing to experience over, you know, the past 6-7 days or so.
It has. And yeah, it's, you know, the timing was, well, one, they're both in better places now. I mean, by all accounts, Smith and Tarkanian both over the past 3 or 4 years,
sure.
Their health was just absolutely declining at a rapid rate. For them to have died so close to each other, it really has allowed us to not necessarily compare the men, but to show, one, that there are no coaches around today who are similar in style and personality and stature as what Dean was and as what Tark was, and particularly with Tark, since we talked plenty about Dean on the Monday podcast. You know, I wish there was a coach that was so... I mean, that was just so willing to be a thorn on the rose for the NCAA. There isn't someone like that today. And there isn't a coach like Tark willing to just, like, in some ways, Calipari, I guess, is close. But really, with the way that Tark, like, think about those UNLV teams. And Parrish, you wrote about this in your column, and we very much have this in common in that. Those UNLV teams are really some of our earliest memories of both college basketball and really beginning to love the sport, sure. with what those guys did. So Kentucky, like UNLV was the most polarizing team of that era, okay? And Kentucky is the most polarizing team of this era. Well, the difference is you almost watch Kentucky – and I say you as a general sports population, watch Kentucky because maybe there's some sort of animosity for Calipari, a general interest if they're going to go undefeated. You watched UNLV because they were just a bunch of bad dudes that scored 110 points and would, if they were beating you by 25, they wanted to beat you by 35. Like, Tark ran a program, yes, it was naturally rebellious in a lot of ways, but it was also super, super fun. And Dan Wetzel hit on this in his column. You know, he was a character in a sport that tends to breed coaches that are just too conservative, too PC savvy, and Tark in many ways was a breath of fresh air. And I do wish we had – I mean, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of good guys in college basketball, sure. and there are a few, you know, interesting cats here and there, but there just isn't anyone like Tark. There never will be. And I wish we even had just a handful of guys that were – willing to speak out more. And the amazing thing about Tark is he's got, you know, a little bit of this tarnish on him in terms of having run from the NCAA and whatever, but everyone that covered him respected him for how honest and forthcoming he was with who he was, who his program was. And just to circle back to what you were saying, GP, you know, he definitely wanted to have those, you know, that recognition late in life because he wanted so desperately to be seen as an equal to a lot of those coaches he coached against. And I think he was, but it came so late because he was willing to say, listen, this is how a lot of guys are doing it, but you know, I'm willing to tell you how we do it. and it's not going to always be pretty, but I'm not going to be phony about it. And I think now we appreciate that more about Tark than maybe his contemporaries did in the 70s.
I want to get back to this in just a second. I want to bring Sam in really quickly. Tark's main message, I think, when it came to all that kind of NCAA stuff was, okay, maybe I am that guy, but so is the guy I'm competing with. And so is the guy you think's great. And so is the guy you can't imagine ever going outside of the lines. Like, I ain't by myself. Why am I the only one on that poster when more guys are at our level are like me than not? That was his message, more than anything else. And I think it was a completely fair message I think it was a fair point to make. His famous quote, 9 out of 10 schools are cheating and the other one's in last place. That was his basic point always. Fine, I'm the bad guy. But there's a lot of bad guys. I ain't the only one. Sam, you're too young to remember any of this, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much. I went back on Wednesday and watched a few, like, found, like, UNLV games online that I could, like, watch and really, really try and remember what Tarkanian was doing. Just because, yeah, I was too young. I was 2 or 3 whenever those UNLV teams were dominant. And the one that lost to Duke, I want to say I was 2. So, yeah, like, I was
good
too young
for you,
to really,
by the way.
I'm really too young to really like remember them generally, but I went back and watched a few of them, and yeah, they were fantastic basketball. That team ran, and they tried to score on you every possession, and they tried to just dominate you. And God, I wish there was a team like that. Right now, like, yeah. In the worst way, I wish there was a team like that. But I will say this: like, I wonder if Tarkanian, as far as his ideas on the NCAA, just came an era too early. Like, if he was around now. Like, I wonder what we would think of him within the context of the O'Bannon case and within the context of...
He would be
of,
celebrated because the yeah. stuff he said then is the stuff Jay Billis tweets now.
Absolutely,
great
yeah.
point. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, like, it just kind of sucks for him that he never really got that recognition whenever he was around guys like Dean Smith that were, like, flawless as far as their media perception and other guys of that stature. Whenever now, like, it would be... He'd be a perfect fit, and he'd be exactly what we need in the NCAA.
And just a real quick note on, you know, we can wrap this up if you want to move on, but Dean Smith was decades ahead in terms of his analysis of basketball on a per-possession basis, like ridiculously ahead in the 50s, 4 decades ahead, and Tarkanian was a solid 3 decades ahead. This whole thing started with him in the NCAA because he wrote, like, guest columns for his local newspaper that kind of essentially bashed the NCAA, and that got them onto his trail, and they never really got off of it. But the things he was saying really weren't even remotely addressed in terms of media, let alone coaches, until the early 2000s. So both pioneers in that kind of way.
I do want to touch on a couple of different things. So Wednesday night, again, after Tark had died, I was in studio, CBS Sports Network, with Ala Abdelnaby. And Ala, who's a great guy, like, he's just the best. He was on the Duke team that lost by 30 to UNLV in the 1990 championship game. And I thought it was interesting because this was before Krzyzewski had a title, right? They won the next year. But, you know, Krzyzewski's still, you know, a relatively unaccomplished coach. Not really. He'd gone, I think, to 3 Final Fours. So, but he had not – they hadn't broken through yet. Is that right, Norlander?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. He was actually, you know, in some ways he was like an early Dean Smith in that right. He had made a bunch. He might have been to more than 3. He might have been to, like –
Maybe. I know Ala went to 3, and that was Ala's last. So if he might have went to 1 before Ala. So whatever the number is, that's not the point. The point is this. So Ala's telling a story about being in that game. And he said, people don't remember, they were actually only down 10 at the half. It felt like they were down 50, but they were down 10 at the half. And, you know, Bobby Hurley was a freshman point guard and just wasn't equipped. I think he said Bobby, and again, he's working off of memory from long ago, but he said the way he remembers it, Bobby had 7 turnovers in the first 11 minutes of the game. But this is what I found most interesting and sort of a glimpse into the mind of Krzyzewski. He pulled Ala and the other seniors with 10 minutes to go, took them out of the game. And Ala was like, because he didn't want that to he didn't want us to have to go through that. It was over for us, and he didn't want us on the court being embarrassed like that. Like, we're in enough highlights already. Ala was like, I've seen myself on TV today more than I've seen myself in a long time. He said, but Kay didn't want us to have to go through with that. He said, but Bobby and Christian, he left them on the court the entire time. He wanted it to sting. He wanted it to never, you get, no, get dunked on again. No, turn it over again. Hurt, cry, hurt. And he said, and he was trying to put them through something that hopefully they'd come out stronger. And I thought that was an interesting point from Ala, like being inside that lock, in that side, that program. Kay pulled the seniors because he didn't want them to be embarrassed any more than they already were. But he left the other guys, Bobby, Christian, all those guys. And then they come back, of course, and they win the national championship the next year. The other thing I wanted to touch on before we move on, and we are about to move on. You mentioned John Calipari. As I talked to, you know, as like the modern day Tark, and that is the comparison a lot of people make, and I think it's fair on a lot of levels in the sense that they're both guys who have had programs endured issues. I don't want to say operated outside of the lines of the rules because Cal would reject that, even though he's had two Final Fours vacated. So I'll just say he's had two Final Fours vacated. He's had issues with the NCAA, and he's also, you know, recruited at a high level, enrolled guys with some questionable backgrounds, although he does it much less at Kentucky than he ever did at, say, Memphis or UMass, certainly at Memphis. And I talked to Tark for a long time about Cal. Like, he loved John Calipari. He loved the idea of John Calipari. I think the main difference between Tark and Cal, though, is that Cal has never wanted to be the outsider. One of the real desires of John forever, honestly, was to get on, and this is his phrase to me once upon a time, to get on the right side of the rope. And he had always been on the wrong side. Like, he's at UMass winning at a high level, so he's the devil. He's at Memphis winning at the high level, so he's a cheater. But what do you say about the guy at Kentucky? Like, can you ever get a job, you know, a blue blood, a Kansas job, a Kentucky job, a UCLA job, an Indiana job? And John always, I don't care what he says, always had a desire to be viewed differently or to be viewed in a way other than that's the modern day Jerry Tarkanian. So Tark, I don't think, really had much of a desire while he was coaching to be anything other than, I'll be the thorn in the NCAA. I'll be the renegade guy. I'll recruit the kid straight out of jail. I don't care. Whereas Cal has done a lot of those things, not necessarily out of jail, but certainly out of juvenile. I'll do a lot of those things, but he never wanted. I don't think he's ever embraced being the so-called renegade the way Tark embraced it. John always wanted to be the coach at some place like the University of Kentucky. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And man, the more you talk about it, I think that is right. But I do think they've got a lot in common as
Sure.
Particularly, I think because they were both primarily early on known as only recruiters and not good coaches, and both have really Yes. dismissed that. And both sought the approval of their colleagues, and both have received that. But yes, in terms of within the coaching ranks, how they, you know, wanted to be perceived, I think there is a difference there. And, you know, I think the things we're saying about Tark, some of them to a degree will be echoed, you know, decades down the road with Calipari.
No question. And you're exactly right about the perceptions in terms of, oh, he's just a great recruiter, not a good coach. Oh, you know what? Probably a better coach than we've realized. That was certainly true for Tark. And I think now, though you'll still get a little pushback, I think now it is almost universally accepted about John Calipari as well. Like, he's not just a recruiter, and anybody who suggests that is not paying close enough attention. Let's move on. So the mock selection process is going on in Indianapolis right now, and whatever. It's like, it feels like we've done it for 10 years.
I hope David Warlock is somehow listening to this podcast over the weekend, the NCAA communication advisor.
No.
Mock process is going on, and whatever.
Yeah, no. It's just like, I see it all over Twitter, and like, yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm a little over it at this point, although it is a great exercise, and the NCAA is kind and smart to do it. That should keep Warlock happy, right? I did find this interesting. So they went through it the way that you would go through it. And last night, They set the number one seeds, and the number one seeds were Kentucky, Virginia, Duke, Wisconsin, no Gonzaga. Sam, you agree with that?
I don't have a problem with it, I would say.
I think that's exactly my response. I don't agree, but I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, that's basically where I'm at. I think that we're kind of rewarding Wisconsin for losing without Frank Kaminsky in a way. Like, that loss to Rutgers is a really, really bad loss.
Rutgers has not won since that game, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, like, that is an incredibly bad loss. There's no circumstance where you should lose that game without Frank Kaminsky and a half of Trey Jackson. Like, they have better wins, but Gonzaga's beaten they destroyed a really, really good SMU team. They beat Georgia by, like, what, 15 or so? They beat St. John's by, like, 10. They beat UCLA by, like, 15. They went into BYU and won, which St. Mary's learned last night isn't easy.
They beat SMU. Did you say SMU?
Yeah, they beat SMU by, like, 15, didn't
right. they? Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. That was early.
Yeah. So, like, this is clearly a number one level team, in my opinion. Like, it's not like they didn't go out and schedule non-conference. Like, they tried to put Memphis on their schedule, and Memphis is just terrible.
Right.
Like, there's nothing they can really do about that. They went into UCLA, and I think they're the only team to beat UCLA at Pauley this year. Like, their resume is pretty good, I think. And I think that I don't know that we're rewarding Wisconsin for losing at Rutgers, but I think that we're just ignoring it in a way that we shouldn't.
That is exactly what's happening. It's basically Frank didn't play. I don't even think you can say Trayvon got hurt because Trayvon is hurt. So, like, whatever. But
yeah.
But certainly it is Frank didn't play, so who cares? And I actually kind of, like, I can get down with that as well. Like, Frank didn't play, so who cares? I can get down with that. I just, here's my struggle with this. And it is genuine. Like, I don't have to see the tournament, so whatever. But on one hand, if we talk about quality of resumes, I think by the end of this, first off, here's what I think. By the end of this, I think Duke's going to take some losses.
Probably.
And they're going to fall off that line. And so I think by the end of this, we're going to have Kentucky, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Gonzaga. So I think Virginia and Duke will knock each other. And I think it'll be Virginia knocking Duke. But I think they'll knock each other out, whether it's because Duke takes some losses or one of them beats the other one in the ACC tournament. But I think that'll sort itself out. So I do believe Gonzaga is going to be there at the end because I don't think Gonzaga is losing again. I don't think Virginia is going to lose enough, and I don't think Kentucky's losing at all. But right now, which is what they were basing this on one hand, I go, you're telling me a team that is so clearly good, according to the eye test, the statistical analysis, and the resume only features an overtime loss at Arizona that might not should have been a loss if an official would have called a foul that was so clearly a foul at the end of regulation.
Yep.
You're telling me that team doesn't deserve a one seed? Get out of here.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they've only got three top 50 wins. Basically, everybody in contention for a one's got twice as many. On the other hand, that's got everything to do with the league affiliation and nothing to do with the quality of the basketball team. So where do you go with this?
See, yeah, I was actually going to go the other way on this, too, because their league right now is, like, a clear seventh out of what are there? They're, like, 30 leagues.
Sure.
They're like, clearly seventh. They're ahead of the Atlantic 10. They're ahead of the Missouri Valley. They're ahead of the Mountain West. They're ahead of the AAC. Like, this isn't a bad league this year. It's a clear step down from your Power 6 leagues. But, like, the West Coast Conference is not a terrible league. Pepperdine's a tough place to play. Portland's pretty good. You have there's another team. San Diego's decent. Plus, you got SMC and BYU that are both like pretty strong programs who should be in it for an at large at some point if they keep winning. So I don't really buy even the conference argument in a lot of ways because there are a lot more landmines this year than there have been in the past for Gonzaga, and they're dodging them all with relative ease.
Yeah, they're beating the hell out of it. Like last night, they were up like 20-0.
They were, I know. And the one thing, I think the one with all this mock stuff, and you know, diehard fans follow college basketball writers, so it's a very tiny percentage of fans that are even aware of this kind of stuff. But the ones that do, I think the thing they still don't quite connect, and you really have to go through the process, I guess, to fully understand that this is true, is the conference you're in and that conference's strength really don't play into how you're seated because you don't look at the teams and the resumes in that kind of window and through that perspective. So it's more the opponents that you've played that factors in more. So the fact that the WCC is either the seventh conference definitively overall or is perceived as a weak conference, those things can kind of be independent to how people assess Gonzaga. I am so intrigued with Gonzaga. Just they should be a one seed. I think they will be a one seed. And then what are they going to do when they get there? Obviously, we'll address that as we get closer to the tournament. But there are a few teams that I'm more intrigued with overall than Mark Few's. And I'm also going to be interested to see if Wichita State and you and I basically win out except losing against each other in whatever kind of combination that is. If those two teams don't lose another game the rest of the season except if it's to one another, how they are seeded, because I think they're both really good teams worthy of six seeds or better, and I think that that could happen. But we'll wait and see. I'm just, you know, last year the Valley, obviously Wichita State runs the table. Parrish and I were in agreement. They should have been a one seed, and they were, and they just got a brutal matchup in the second round with Kentucky. This year, obviously, hasn't run the table, but they could be a two- or a three-loss team when they get there. Is that going to be seven-seed territory? I don't know. I'm very intrigued to see what the committee does with both those teams.
I think both of them should be six or better seeds. And I do think, as long as they only lose to each other going forward, they play on the 28th. In Wichita, and then presumably would meet again in St. Louis in the MVC tournament. I actually might go to Wichita for that. You know, it's the week before the most schools, the power schools, have a regular season finale. And, like, what's better than, you know, two top 20 teams deciding a league championship, you know, in Cocoa? Like, what's better than that? I might actually – it could be Ron Baker's last game at Wichita State.
Right.
I'm not trying to put – panic button or anything, but it could theoretically be Greg Marshall's last game in that arena. So, I mean, if he wants it to be, it certainly will be. I mean, he could leave whenever he wants. And so, I don't know. I was thinking about going there. I'm really intrigued by Wichita having a true challenger this season. Mm-hmm. And because I think that Northern Iowa team's good. Seth Tuttle could end up being the MVC player of the year, even if Baker and Van Vliet mm-hmm. are both awesome. So, like, I don't know. I'm just sort of intrigued by all that. Let's forget the February 28th weekend. We can look at that one on February 27th. Let's look at this weekend. I think the most interesting game on some level is Villanova at Butler. It's on CBS Sports Network, 6 o'clock Eastern on Saturday night. And so it's for first place in the Big East. I actually, right before we started recording this, I was on the phone with Chris Holtman and the Butler coach. Think about this. In a span of 5 months, he's gone from being an assistant coach at Butler to being the full-time head coach of a nationally ranked team at Butler that is about to play the, quote, biggest game in the history of Hinkle Fieldhouse, according to the Indianapolis Star. How wild is that?
It's crazy. Yes.
Listen, I went to Butler last week, caught a game. Holtman is handling this pretty terrifically. That's even crazy to think about, and that this could be the biggest game for Butler ever in that building.
No, they're not even saying that. I mean, they're throwing Milan in there. This is the big, yeah. And I don't, first, let me be clear. I have no idea. Who am I to argue about what's the big, I'm just saying the Indianapolis Star called it that. So let's start from there.
And you know, if Butler wins that game, I don't know if they're going to. I really like Villanova. But if they do, they're going to be tied for first in that league. Really, they're going to make the tournament anyway, but that's like if you win it, you're a lock. Like they could lose every other game pretty much and still make the tournament, I feel. It is really Butler's becoming, in a weird way, one of the darling stories. Like you didn't ever think that could be possible again because Butler was Butler under Brad and they were just an established program. But with what the program's gone through since Brad left, it's definitely become something of an underdog again. And for Holtman to have done this has been pretty impressive overall, but I do think Villanova's going to win. I'm pretty high on Villanova overall. If they get the right kind of seed draw in the tournament, I could see myself picking them to reach the Final Four. I think they'll win at Butler, but if not, that's really going to, you know, vault the Bulldogs' overall profile and Holtman as well.
Yeah, I think because it's being played in Hinkle, it's basically a coin flip game. And if you remember the Butler-Gonzaga game at Hinkle a few years back. Like, that was pretty big, too. There's a floater at the buzzer. There's Brad calmly walking to center court to shake hands with Mark Hughes.
That's a great call. I forgot about it. Like, it happens, and he is just strutting.
Oh, I love that. I love that scene. It was great. Because for folks who don't remember, like, Google it. It's terrific. So the ball is in the air. Like, was it Roosevelt? I want to say Roosevelt Jones. Was it? I might be making that up.
Right.
No, I think you're right. I think it's Rosie. He hits like this weird floater.
Okay. So yeah. So the ball is in the air and it hasn't gone. It's on the way. It's either going in or it's not going in, and who knows. And Brad, if you watch the sideline and take your eyes off the ball, Brad is like you do at the buzzer, walk to half court to shake the hand of the opposing coach. He's walking already. And he just so calmly, and like he's already on his way. And this got a lot of attention because it's like, dude, the ball is in the air and like the whole place is getting ready to go crazy. And Brad Stevens is just walking to shake Mark Few's hands. And I remember talking to Brad about this, and he was great. I mean, it's sort of a glimpse into the mind of Brad. He said, at that point, the ball's in the air. I've done my job. You know, everything I could possibly do had been done. And to me, it doesn't matter whether that ball goes in or not, because we put ourselves in a position to win. We have an opportunity to win. Now it's just up to the ball. Like, the ball goes in, it doesn't go in. And I'm not going to feel much differently about the job that I did or about the job my kids did based on whether that ball goes in or not. So it's over for me. I'm going to shake hands. And then, of course, it goes in and everybody goes berserk and whatever. But I just thought that was a really interesting observation that from Brad. Like, I can watch it and then, like, you know, grab my head and cry if it doesn't go in, or jump up and down if it does go in. But whether it does go in or doesn't go in has nothing to do with whether or not I did my job tonight. Like, my kids did their jobs. I did my job. So let's go ahead and start the walk to midcourt. I love that scene. One of my favorite scenes in college basketball the past few years.
Yeah. And, it's interesting that I don't know if you had brought this up or if you didn't ask it in the course of that conversation, but it's almost like, once you've seen what happened with Gordon Hayward, like, yeah, it's just like, you know what, if it goes in, it goes in, if it doesn't, it doesn't. But like, once you've been standing, watching, and seeing that ball hang in the air and come so close to falling in and really just changing the landscape of college basketball, you know, a shot by Roosevelt Jones in the Hinkle Fieldhouse is certainly a huge one, but nothing by comparison. So I wonder if that is backdrop in his mind.
All right. The other thing, so I was talking to Holtman this morning, and I'm going to write all this later on this afternoon. I thought this was interesting. You know, he's a pretty interesting guy. I've got to know a little bit over the past, I don't know, 5 months or so. And, you know, he fell into this job for circumstances. For people who don't know the story, Brandon Miller was the head coach. Chris was just his assistant. Brandon had to take a leave. And then Chris got the job as an interim basis, which basically is code for, let's see how you do, guy. And if it goes well, then maybe you'll get the job. And if it doesn't, well, then maybe you'll be looking for a new employment in March. Cause then, you know, Butler could just announce it. If this season went the way it was supposed to go, like eighth in the Big East, then Butler could theoretically, probably would, just announce that, you know, now they're going to have a national search for a new coach, and we appreciate Chris for his work over the past few months. And so one of the things he said, which I thought was a very human moment, instead of being all basketball coachy and whatever, he said, you know what, like, I felt an immense amount of pressure. And not just because I'm suddenly the head coach at Butler. Like, usually you become the head coach at Butler or something like Butler. That happens in March or April. You got several months to sort of get comfortable and understand, wear the shirts and speak to the booster clubs. And then the season starts and whatever. Like, I became the coach at Butler and now the season's starting. So you have pressure that hasn't really made sense to you yet already. Like, it's inherent. He said, but the other thing I could never get out of my head, he said, you know, I've got one assistant coach who's got two kids and a third on the way. I've got another assistant coach who's got three children. I've got another assistant coach that whatever. And I could never get out of my head, if I screw this up, all of them are looking for jobs at the end of this. It's not just me. Like, at least my life's in my own hands to some degree. But it's not like coaching for 4 years at a school and then you're on the hot seat, because you've had 4 years to get yourself away from that moment. Basically, hey, here's the job. Now, do great now, or do really well now. Impress us now, or else you won't have this job 4 months from now. And if you don't have this job 4 months from now, none of these other guys have this job 4 months from now. And did you remember that your assistant coach has a baby on the way? And he was like, that just overwhelmed me at times. Like, I, you know, it was just a lot to carry. And so certainly not feeling a sense of relief now. He's fired up and excited and nervous and all the things you would be about tomorrow's game against Villanova. But to get the interim tag removed and get a multi-year contract where you know no matter what happens tomorrow, you're not interviewing for the job anymore right now. You're going to be the coach at Butler next year no matter what, is a huge accomplishment for him. And I thought it was interesting for him to talk about that, like not knowing early and having other people's lives and careers in your hands was a really stressful thing for him. And I guess on a completely human level, that makes sense to any of us, right?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's, I think, it's an overlooked part of the job for a lot of guys, because let's face it, that's not what we're paid to write about. It's not what we're paid to consider a lot of times, but it is a real continual heavy aspect of the job for anyone that takes a head coaching job. Chris's is so very different from most other situations, sure, for all the reasons that you listed. But sure, the pressure to do well, to help men who are your friends and whose wives and children you get to know and see on a nearly daily basis, is certainly a very heavy part of it. And you know, I'm glad you're right. I'm glad you're writing this, GP, because one, the Holtmann story should be written, but two, especially if Butler wins and if Butler winds up going to the Big East tournament, makes the title game and gets a 5 seed or whatever, the Holtmann story is really going to be part of the College Hoops news cycle, writing cycle, oh, maybe to the point of saturation by the end of March. So I'm glad that this is getting kind of told a few weeks ahead of time, because he's a good guy. I think he's a get it guy. I mean, I sat with him in his office and I was kind of self-deprecating, saying, yeah, this is kind of awkward. I picked you guys eighth. And he's like, and you should have.
Right.
Like, he kind of just gets like, he wasn't like giving me any sort of flack. He's like, you know, if I was a member of the media, I would have thought we'd have been about eighth as well. Like, he admits that the way that the team has played has been really surprising. There's just a lot of very interesting angles to Chris Holtmann, that program, how he landed here, and the way that he really embraces the fact that his story is going to want to be told, and he does it in a very responsible way, because the fact of the matter is the circumstances which Brandon Miller left that program remain mysterious, and he is very, very respectfully private of Brandon, his situation, and he kind of just leaves that outside in a way that I think a lot of coaches might mishandle. He's done a good job with that.
Really good job. And like, just to bottom line it with Butler, how many other Big East schools would you how many Big East schools would you trade rosters with Butler? Maybe Marquette? Maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe Creighton? But like, it maybe not, though. At least like Marquette, you get Carlino, you get Juwan Johnson. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's done a terrific job. The idea that you know, by the time we go to bed on Saturday night, Butler could be tied for first in the Big East. First off, Butler tied for first in the Big East, period. Butler, which was in the Horizon League a couple years ago, tied for first in the Big East. Crazy. For Butler, with a guy who was an assistant coach 5 months ago, tied for first in the Big East after being in the Horizon just a few years. It's all bananas and a terrific. So I'm actually looking forward to sitting down and writing it this afternoon, even if I've got a million other things to do. Speaking of, we got to get out of here. But first, Sam, last week on this podcast, you had Notre Dame over Duke. So do you want to pick a big game tomorrow?
Yeah, no, I should probably stay away from that at this point.
No. Sam, you're picking a game.
Last week you had Notre Dame over Duke, and then Duke won by 70.
35, yeah. Okay.
So, please give us a pick for tomorrow. And it's got to be a high-profile game. You want Baylor, Kansas? Or do you want Ohio State, Michigan State? Pick any of them, Sam. Give us a winner.
Oh, God. Ohio State beats Michigan State.
Oh, my God. I didn't say Buckeye Sam pick it. Yeah.
I just don't think Michigan State's very good. It's more that. But I think that Ohio State's pretty good. I think they're starting to get hot. And I think that Michigan State kind of, like I said, isn't very good.
They're going to go into the Breslin Center and win. Sam Carter.
So now expect Michigan State to go in and win by 15.
The same way Sam had Notre Dame going into Cameron Indoor last weekend to win.
Denzel Valentine's going to shut down D'Angelo Russell, and everything's going to be totally wrong again.
All right. If you make or miss, we will talk about it again next week. Let's get out of here. Remember, you can subscribe to the Iowan College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. Make sure to do that. Quickest way to get your hands on the latest editions. And regardless, we're going to be back Monday. Till then, take care.